accession number 11211, reel 1.
Old Malabar, Reel 1, Malabar.
Chesterley Street, County Durham, on the 25th of July, 1924.
Did you have brothers and sisters in the family?
I had an older sister and a younger brother.
And your father, what was his occupation?
My father worked for the old Cooperative Wholesale Society as a driver.
Did your mother work?
No, my mother never worked.
What kind of area is Chesterley Street?
It was a mining town. There's very little else there now.
Did your mother work?
No.
And was life easy at home or was it difficult?
It wasn't too bad as far as I was concerned. My father had a steady job, which a lot of people didn't have. And life was more comfortable than for most people in the area.
You would go to school at 5 years of age. Which school did you go to?
I went to a little Church of England school in Chesterley Street at first. And after a while I left there and went to another infant school while I was still very young, also in Chesterley Street. But we left Chesterley Street when I was 10 years of age. That was in 1934. And we moved to Newcastle. And I went to school there from then on.
And whereabouts in Newcastle did you go?
We lived in a suburb called North Fenham, in a flat, a rented flat.
And was this because of your father's work?
He just considered it was an improvement. It was a newly built house. He couldn't decide whether he could afford to buy a house or not, and he ended up in this newly built flat, which he rented.
What was life like at home at this time, childhood?
Well, I certainly didn't have any great problems. We lived on the edge of the town moor in Newcastle, so there was plenty of airy open space to play about, and life was just quite pleasant, really.
What was the name of the school at Newcastle that you went to?
Cypress Avenue. I've forgotten the rest of it. It was that was its name, Cypress Avenue. It was a council school. While I was there, I sat two scholarship exams, one for Rutherford College, as it then was, and the other one was for a junior technical school, so that I had the choice of going to either of those. But Dad put his foot down and said, no, the thing you've got to do is to leave school at 14 and I'll get you a job in the cooperative movement, which was a great thing in his life. So I had to leave school at 14 and I began work for the Newcastle Co-op.
And what was your first job with the Co-op?
I worked in the flower room of one of the branches in Fenham in Newcastle. And my job was to put flour into paper bags and wrap them up and send them up in a hoist to the shop when the shop assistants shouted down the stairs at me. Eventually I did another little exam and they gave me a better job as a junior clerk in the head office at Newgate Street in Newcastle. And that's where I was until I left that employment at the Co-op.
What were your wages?
At the best, about 12 shillings a week.
Was that considered good in those days?
It was average, I suppose. Nobody had very much, so nobody thought they were poor.
What hours did you work?
Normally I worked from 9 o'clock in the morning until 6, with a half an hour for lunch. But in the initial part of my employment with the Co-op, when I was at this branch working in the flower room, there were certain nights when we had to work till midnight. And occasionally I used to have to go out on the cart bring groceries, helping out the regular delivery people, and that could last until midnight, certainly around about Christmas time and holidays. And of course, at that time, I was only 14, 15, 16 years of age.
Did you work 6 days a week?
Yes.
And that included working till 6 on a Saturday, did you?
Yes.
With just the Sunday? Did you join any organisations like the Boy Scouts or the Church Lads Brigade?
No, I wasn't in any organisation like that.
And you worked there until war came, is that correct?
Yes. I worked there until I was 18, 1942, and that was when I left that employment to go in the army.
Do you recall what you were doing or where you were when war broke out?
Yes, I remember it very clearly. I was at home. I think I would be 15. Anyway, it came over the radio that war had been declared, so this didn't bother me, being young and daft, and I went off to pick up my friend and go out with him. But when I got to his house, he and the rest of his family were in the air raid shelter, which was a thing half buried in the back garden of their house. It was what we call an Anderson shelter, which was a corrugated iron thing covered with soil, and you had to go down a couple of steps into it. And to make matters worse, his mother had a gas mask on. They were so sure that an attack was imminent because war had just been declared. So I had to kid them out of this and get my friend out, and off we went for a walk or something.
Were there any other ways in which the outbreak of war seemed to be imminent in those early days before it actually happened? Were there any other signs?
Yes. I had an uncle who's dead now, but who was a Methodist minister in America. He was my father's brother, and he went to America when he was very young. But he came to visit us in 1938, and this was the first time I'd seen him. And while he was here, we were being fitted with our gas masks. All the civilian population was being issued with these primitive gas mask things. And he went along with us to see what was happening. And he had himself fitted with a gas mask before they found out that he was an alien and had to take it from him and chase him.
He didn't tell them that he was from America?
No. He was just one of the family until it came out while he was going through the details of getting fitted out with this gas mask thing. And as I say, they found out he was a foreigner and chased him.
Do you recall when the first of the Anderson shelters were being placed in homes?
Yes. This was before the war. That must have been about 1938 as well. We couldn't have one in our back garden because in the area where I lived, there was a lot of old underground mine workings, and the ground was very unsafe, particularly along the back of the houses where we were. So we had to share with a family on the other side of the street, which was on rather firmer.
Were you given any instructions on how to look after yourself if the war was declared and there were such things as air raids prior to the war itself?
I don't remember anything in particular about that, no. Of course, I was very young and I probably wasn't taking much notice.
What are your earliest memories of the war before you actually joined it?
When I was working in the general office of the co-op in the centre of Newcastle, I remember seeing soldiers marching through the streets and all the shop girls hanging out of the windows to have a look at them. But that's about the only thing. Except that I had a friend who was in the band of the Durham Light Infantry, as it happened, and he was a regular soldier. And I remember seeing him about the place in his uniform. And he eventually ended up in the 1st Battalion, and he was killed in Sicily at Primosoli Bridge.
How did it come about that you joined the forces?
Well, as soon as I was 18, I had to register for military service. And I expressed a preference for the army because my father had been in the army in the First World War. I couldn't think of any other reason. And I was called up eventually on the 3rd of December 1942, when I was still 18, and sent to Richmond in North Yorkshire, where there was a basic training camp, which was run jointly by the East Yorkshire Regiment and the Green Howards. And I was there for 6 weeks doing basic training and intelligence and aptitude tests, so-called. And at the end of that 6 weeks, I was told that I was an ideal man for the Royal Corps of Signals.
But I didn't. Why did they say that? How did they come to that decision?
Well, they did various intelligence and aptitude tests, but there was one in particular where they simulated Morse code. Well, I'd been a signaller in the Home Guard, a very young Home Guard. I was about 16, and I told them I was older, and I spent about 18 months in the Home Guard before I was called up for military service. So I was familiar with Morse code, and this is the only reason I can think of why they thought this young man will be a good signaller.
So you'd lied about your age to get into the Home Guard. Was this very early on?
This was when shortly after the Home Guard was formed, which was maybe about 1941.
Do you have any memories of the state of the Home Guard in those days?
Well, where I was, there weren't the big laugh that they were portrayed later. They were very well organised in battalions and companies. Of course, it was a city. It was in Newcastle upon Tyne. And I was in the 11th West Newcastle Battalion, and I was in headquarter company, and I was a signaller. And we used to go off to the range and fire off rifles and Thompson submachine guns and Browning automatic rifles, and I would practice Morse code and waving flags. And every now and then we'd have an exercise where so-called regular troops would attack our positions, and we thought we were all right. We didn't think that we were like the kind of dad's army that you see on television now.
Did you have weapons almost from the beginning?
Yes, we had Canadian rifles, Ross rifles, there were. But we also had various other automatic weapons, like the Browning automatic and Thompson submachine guns, grenades and things. And we were properly organised into units and companies and things.
How did you take to the discipline of life in the Home Guard after a civilian life at home?
I liked it. I've always liked a bit of discipline.
No problems?
No.
So that you learned some rudiments of signalling in the Home Guard.
Yeah.
When you went through your basic training with the East Yorkshire Regiment, what did it entail being a signaller in the Army?
Well, most of the time we seemed to be using the number 18 wireless set, which was a big, heavy thing. It weighed 56 pounds and we carried it on our backs. But we also did field telephone, laying lines in the field, operating field telephones, operating field switchboards. We had metal switchboards that we humped about with us and connected up to various companies and positions. We also learned how to use flags, to use Morse code. We never did semaphore, which was a naval thing. We just did Morse code with one flag. And we had various other things. A heliograph, we were trained in the use of that. And a thing called a fuller phone, which scrambled the speech that was being passed about the place.
Can you describe some of those instruments? The 18 set, how did it get its name, 18 set?
It was just the Mark 18 radio telephone set, really. It was in a big brass case, and it weighed 56 pounds. It had a canvas cover on the back, which opened up to get at the controls, the dials and things. We wore headphones. At first we wore headphones. I used to end up with them around my neck, though, because one big disadvantage of being a signaller is you can't hear what's going on around you. And you've just got to rely on looking at all the people around, and when they dive under the ground, you dive under the ground, and this nasty big radio comes up your back, hits you on the back of the head and knocks your helmet over your eyes. So I used to keep the headphones hung around my neck and hope I could hear what was going on. And it had an aerial, of course, which stuck up in the air. It could be as long as 16 feet long, and it waved about and rattled on the side of your helmet. And that was the thing that certainly... in action, that's the thing we used more than anything.
What kind of range had it?
About 10 miles. There were smaller radios in the platoons which kept in touch with companies, but the signalers belonged to Battalion HQ and were attached to rifle companies, so there was one 18 set with each rifle company, and also with specialist subunits like the mortar platoon or the anti-tank platoon. They each had a signaller type, but we were all for all intents and purposes, we were in one section, the signal section, which was number one platoon of battalion headquarters company.
Was it a very efficient instrument?
It was. It certainly served its purpose as far as we were concerned. It had its drawbacks. You could get into a position where you couldn't hear the person you were wanting to speak to. If you were under a metal bridge, for instance, or under an arch or something, or even sometimes behind a hill, if there was a lot of iron about the place, you'd have difficulty. But normally, it worked very well.
It didn't break down too much?
No.
No problems with that?
No.
Now, what about some of the other instruments you mentioned, Dan?
Well, the field telephone would come next. It was in a brass case. In fact, while the war was going on, we tended to leave them on the truck and use the captured German instruments because they were much lighter than ours and more efficient. They were made of Bakelite instead of, which was a primitive kind of plastic, instead of the brass that ours were, and they were much lighter. And we used to lay lines, as I say, from battalion headquarters to companies, or forward from companies to observation posts. And one of us would always be operating the switchboard at battalion headquarters.
And these lines would be laid across the ground, in the open?
Either on the ground or in the trees, depend upon the circumstances. It was a single line. We used to operate on what was called the earth return principle. We used to stick a ground spike in the ground at each end, and that did for the earth. And there was a single line from the telephone to the switchboard, or from one telephone to another. And that was quite effective as well.
You didn't have any problems with that particular instrument?
The only problem was that it would get chewed up if a tank came along, or if a shell landed on it. But normally, you would only use it when you were static, sort of in a static position. And normally it worked very well.
And did you use that throughout the war?
Yes. Yes.
Now, the other things that you mentioned...
The heliograph were never used in action in Europe. I dare say it was used in India or places like that. It's supposed to have a range of about 70 miles under the right conditions. It flashes in the sun, in effect, and you can send Morse code with it. So we were trained in its use, but we never actually used it operationally. Flags, I don't remember ever using operationally, but we were trained in the use of that. That was just a case of holding one flag vertically above your head and waving it about, a little movement for a dot and a long movement for a dash. And while we were sending, we used to say to ourselves, "Idiumpty, idiumpty, umpty, umpty, idi, idi, umpty, umpty." And that was the way we used to send messages, but it worked. Aldous lamps, we were trained in the use of Aldous lamps, which were used for sending Morse, but very rarely used them, really. But we were trained in them. And then there was this other thing which I mentioned called a Fuller phone after its inventor, but we very rarely used that. We were trained in it, and I don't think I ever used it again.
When you went into action, did you find these instruments worked well in actual battle conditions?
Well, yes, normally they did. The problem with the radio was that it had a battery, a rather heavy battery, which lasted 8 hours, which was normally all right, but there were occasions when if a company was cut off, for instance, and it couldn't get another battery to it, the battery would run out.
What happened to you after basic training, Mr. Malabar?
Well, after 6 weeks at Richmond, I was then posted to the East Yorkshire Regiment. And I went to a thing called Specialist Company, which was also in Richmond, but it was in the stables of a stately home called Ask Hall, which was the home of Lord Zetland. And he lived in his stately home, and 200 of us lived in his stables for 3 months, learning to be signallers. We weren't all learning to be signallers. It was a specialist company insofar as it trained signallers, drivers, carrier drivers, mortarmen, machine gunners, all the, what they called specialists as far as infantry work was concerned.
Did you have to sit examinations at various stages of your training for signalling?
Yes, we had to qualify at various speeds of receiving Morse code and the use of the various instruments that we had to use. and one infantry training, of course. And then after 3 months of that, we qualified as signalers. We were entitled to put the coveted flags on our sleeves. And I was posted to the 7th Battalion East Yorkshire Regiment, which was stationed in Croydon.
Did you receive any increase in your basic salary?
No.
Wage, I should say, for signalling?
No. And there's an interesting thing about that, because I was told, as I mentioned earlier, that I was material for the Royal Corps of Signals. And I said I didn't want to go in the Royal Corps of Signals, I wanted to go into the infantry. So this panel of officers that was sorting this business out said, well, wait outside. Then they called me back in and said, you can go into an infantry regiment if you go in as a specialist. So I said, well, I'll go in as a carrier driver. Wait outside. Then when they called me back in, they said, listen, you can go in an infantry regiment, but you can go as a signaller. So I said, righto. The East Yorkshire Regiment was the handiest one, so I went into the East Yorkshire Regiment. Now, if I'd gone into the Royal Corps of Signals, I would have seen less trouble, I probably wouldn't have been wounded a couple of times, and I would have been paid as a tradesman. But as an infantry signaller, you're an infantryman, even though you don't do normal infantry work, you do signalling. But you're up in the sharp end, and the blighters don't even pay you for it.
So, in effect, your qualifications as a signaller in the Royal Corps Signals would have earned you extra money.
One qualification. If I'd been a linesman, or a switchboard operator, or a radio operator, that would have made me a tradesman. As an infantry signaller, I had to learn all of these things and be an infantryman, and not get paid.
And not get paid.
Marvellous, isn't it? I don't know what the position is now, but that's what it was in the Second World War.
So you went into the East Yorkshire Regiment where you did additional training in that special unit. What happened after that?
I was stationed in Croydon, where we just did training. We spent a few weeks in Wales on exercises, and then nothing else happened until we went off to Normandy with the invasion.
And what date was that?
That was in June 44. I'm not sure what date. It was just after D-Day. I'm not sure of the date. It was in the June. That's all I remember.
Where did you land on the continent?
At Ouistreham. I remember that in particular because we'd just been stationed at a place called Westerham in the south of England, and this Ouistreham seemed to be a similar sort of name. And we arrived there and we were dug in on the beach for quite a long time, being shelled by a big gun at Le Havre, which came out of a tunnel in the middle of the day every day, fired a shell onto our beach, and then there was a British monitor, which was, it's like a huge raft thing with a big gun on it, fired a shell back at the German big gun, and it went back into its tunnel, and this happened every day. But after a few weeks of this, they broke the battalion up that I was in, and we were shared out among the battalions of the 50th Division.
You hadn't been in the line at all?
No, just on this beach.
So you're broken up and you were split up, and what happened to you?
I was told to go to the Green Howards, but I found a friendly Yorkshireman who wanted to go to the Green Howards and had been told to go to the Durham Light Infantry, so we managed to work a swap, and I went to the 9th Durham Light Infantry, which were then at a place called Hotto in Normandy. That was in July 1944.
How were you received when you went into the regiment, or the battalion?
Very well. I don't remember having any problems. I think that signalers didn't have any problems because people relied on them quite a bit and had a little bit of respect for them. And my first job was to be posted to work with attached to the mortar platoon. And I rode about in their carriers with them and used my radio. And
the battalion would have seen some action. What
oh yes, the battalion. The battalion had seen a lot of action. And in fact, it suffered very heavy casualties, which was probably the reason for me being there, arriving there. They were out of the line when I joined them. The thing I remember about them was they had a pet goat at battalion headquarters, and every time the shells started to come over, the goat used to beat everybody into the trenches. This was about the time of the Falaise Gap fighting, and I remember being at Falaise with them and the various places around there. I've never seen so many dead bodies as I did around that place. And the biggest memory I have of Normandy is the smell of rotting bodies. Germans, fortunately, most of them.
Who was commanding the battalion at this time?
Colonel Mogg had just taken over the battalion then.
And you said your first task was with the mortar platoon.
Yeah.
Can you describe the kind of work and duties that you were performing with the mortar platoon?
Well, my job was to... the mortar platoon were mounted on what were normally known as Bren gun carriers, but in their case they carried a 3-inch mortar on the machine, and one of them carried the signaller with his radio. And really his job was to keep in touch with battalion headquarters and pass on the tasks required to the officer who was commanding the water platoon.
Do you recall any particularly difficult tasks you had in those very early days with the battalion?
Not really, not at that stage. It was all a bit of a jumble in Normandy at that time. There was an awful lot of fighting going on. The Germans were withdrawing, trying to get out through the Falaise Gap, and largely it was a question of chasing them. We seemed to be constantly on the move.
When you got to the battalion, Mr. Malabar, was there any indication as to what their morale, what standard of morale they had?
Well, they were feeling pretty shattered. They'd had some terrible experiences, and I got the impression that they were rather weary. But at the same time, they seemed to me to be very professional. They seemed to know exactly what they were doing, and certainly I learned a lot in the first few days with the battalion as to how to operate. Even so far as signalling procedure was concerned, I found that I was using a lot less words to say the same thing with a battalion that was really in action and was used to being in action.
Were you the only signaller with the mortar platoon?
Yes. Yes, there was always one signaller attached to each rifle company, one with the mortar platoon, one with the anti-tank platoon.
So you were expected to get on with your job without necessarily having any experience of doing it under battle conditions?
That's right, yes.
And
without supervision, of course, because the signals officer was always at battalion headquarters and he was responsible for all of the signals throughout the battalion.
Do you recall any of the officers and NCOs of the signal section?
There was a sergeant called Geordie Clay, I remember well. Geordie Clay, he came from Gateshead. He was a good bit older than me. I don't know whether he'll still be alive. There was a corporal called Gilchrist. Can't remember a lot of names now, though.
When you joined them at Hutto, were they under attack, or were they attacking at that time?
No, they were... all that was happening was that they were being shelled from time to time. They weren't actually in action themselves.
And what were your living accommodation like? Were you living in the fields?
We were completely out in the open. Fortunately, at that time, it was quite dry. In fact, the biggest problem was dust at that time. Every time a vehicle moved, it set up a cloud of dust, so we had to move about very slowly. It was very hot. I remember I was well sunburned and bitten by mosquitoes, so there seemed to be millions of mosquitoes. All of my arms were always in shirt sleeves at that time. My arms were all weeping where the mosquitoes had bitten me and around the face. And then there was this horrible smell, of course, because it wasn't just dead persons, it was dead animals as well, because every time any shells came over, there were always a few cows or something in the way, and they were killed and they were lying there.
Was the food a problem, Mr. Mallard?
It never seemed to be a problem. There were sort of petrol-driven stove things. The cooks used to dig a little tunnel and project the flame from underneath it and cook things that way. They used to lay the tins and things across the tops and cook. Of course, we used to sometimes make our own arrangements as well. We used to have... tins of sand which we filled with petrol and lit, and we could cook things over that. Sometimes we could get some potatoes out of a field because we had no bread or potatoes. We seemed to live on dry biscuits and corned beef, so if we could get a few potatoes out of a field and cook them in an old biscuit tin of water, that was a great treat.
And was there any problem with sanitation?
We used to dig. We used to have to dig holes and use those as toilets. Occasionally, when things were quiet, there would be a field shower unit would come up and we would all have a shower. But we would have to be well out of the line to do that. That used to just be set up in a field somewhere. A lot of pipes running across above head level, you know, and water being pumped through them.
What was the kind of terrain that you were operating in?
In Normandy at that time, it was what was known as the Bocage country. Very close, small fields. The roads, unfortunately for us, had steep banks on either side with tight hedges on the top, so that if you were fired on a road, you had a very difficult job to get out because you couldn't scramble up the bank and through the hedge. And it was very difficult for an army that was advancing. It was great for defence. There were a lot of orchards as well. We used to dig in orchards, and we found that was a mistake because shells and mortar bombs burst among the branches of the apple trees and scattered shrapnel about it. So that we soon found out that it was better to dig your hole well out in the open. I vividly remember one occasion when we were dug in one of these little fields, and we'd learned that you dig in round the edges rather than under trees or in the middle.